Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. We are asking today that you reverse the trial court's grant of summary judgment and remand for a trial on plaintiff's claim under Chapter 480-2. The trial we seek would be conducted for the benefit of Ms. Swan and the class that was described in the amended definition adopted by the circuit court in conjunction with the partial settlement. All parties agree that that's the appropriate definition for the class, and that issue, which was briefed, is not part of the appeal in light of the agreement on that point. At that trial, we would present a single claim under Chapter 480-2 based on two intertwined theories as to why the defendant's 38-cent window etch, which they marketed to consumers for hundreds of dollars as a valuable theft deterrent and aid to recovery of stolen vehicles, was unfair and deceptive. The first theory is, of course, that they were marketing illegal insurance. The second intertwined theory is that regardless of whether it was insurance or not, it was unfair and deceptive because the product did not have the represented uses, benefits, and so forth, which is a per se violation, a per se unfair trade practice and deceptive trade practice under the definitions provided in Chapter 481A.
Was that specifically alleged in the complaint?
It was not. It was not. I think it was, as I'll explain, it was within the penumbra of the complaint. Because
why would it not have been specifically alleged?
You have to look at the history of the development of the record and the fact that Detective Hank Nobrega's declaration, was obtained only in September 2004 on the eve of the summary judgment motion. And it's at the point where the police department reveals that it doesn't use those numbers, it doesn't think they're a deterrent, and they're certainly not, in the police department's view, an aid to recovery, that issue as to whether it was simply a spurious product based on the fact that whatever value it may have in other jurisdictions, it has no use in Hawaii or no use on Oahu, comes to light. So,
before this, these lawsuits were initiated, the Office of Consumer Protection filed a complaint. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that case was resolved?
I do not know about the Office of Consumer Protection matter. I know that.
I thought the complaint referred to that case. That you didn't, your plaintiffs did not waive their due process rights by accepting restitution? Or is that a different? Yeah, it says in 47, the allegation, on February 2, 1999, the State Office of Consumer Protection filed a complaint against Cutter defendants on the basis of certain unfair and deceptive trade practices. This action told the statute of limitations for the class members, and on July 20, 2001, a stipulated judgment was filed. It only applied to certain purchasers during a limited period of time. And you go on to say that even if the class, the plaintiffs received money from that settlement, they didn't waive their rights to proceed under this separate claim. So,
yes, and I apologize. I simply can't speak to that this morning. I do not know the history of that and or the details, and I can't respond to that this morning. Okay. In any event, before discussing how the circuit court erred and why remand is necessary, it's important to understand that this appeal is not about two issues. It's not about whether warranties that accompany bona fide products that really serve the promised or represented purpose can be insurance. Nor is it about whether a VIN-based etch, that is an etch system that uses the 17-digit official vehicle identification number of the type that the police department gives away for free, can be a or is a legitimate product. For today, we have no dispute with either of those two issues. Rather, this appeal involves the question whether a proprietary system, a non-VIN etch, if you will, such as the insurance commissioner in his testimony to the legislature indicated was illusory, or such as Detective Nobrega in his declaration in September 2003 indicated was useless, both as a deterrent and as an aid to recovery, constituted an unfair and deceptive practice, the sale of that constituted an unfair and deceptive practice. The appellees contend that the circuit court correctly decided they were not selling insurance and that ended the issue. But they and the circuit court are wrong for three reasons. First, the insurance issue could not be determined as a matter of law. In seeking summary judgment, the Cutter defendants argued, and this is at volume 5 on page 23, quote, because the principal purpose of the VTR window etch product is to deter theft and to aid in recovery of stolen vehicles, the product does not constitute insurance. They effectively conceded that this issue of whether it was a useful and productive product, that it had a real purpose, was a crucial question. In doing that, they then argued, based on law from California and elsewhere, that they weren't selling insurance. But they ignored HRS Chapter 431-1:205, which defines insurance to include warranties for the replacement in the event of any loss or damage to a motor vehicle. They also offered no viable argument against the cases we cited from other jurisdictions, including the Seventh Circuit decision in LaFonda, which said that VTR systems do involve the sale of insurance. But instead, they devoted 5 pages of their memorandum to the argument that this was a bona fide product. They've offered declarations from people around the country. They also offered a declaration from Detective Obriga, which at first glance appeared to say that the police department thought etch systems had some value. Well, in fact, having conceded that the principal purpose test is important and having relied on such a wealth of factual information to build that argument, they effectively conceded, and the circuit court should have recognized, that this purpose test is one of fact, not law. And when the record became complete, when we submitted the testimony of the insurance commissioner, which reflected the findings of his office about the fact that etch systems aren't useful, and when we submitted the declaration from Detective Nobrega that said the police department found that these proprietary etches are useless, then, as a matter of fact, this issue had to go to the jury. The circuit judge could not weigh that and say, as a matter of law, this is a good product.
What was the fact that had to go to the jury that would determine whether or not it was insurance?
Because if the question is, what was the principal purpose of the agreement between Cutter and the consumers with respect to this etch, was the acquisition of a product with a warranty that it really worked, or the sale of simply a contract of indemnity, that's something for the jury to decide. It would be different, I suppose, if we were dealing with the sale of, you know, the much advertised club that people...
It's your position, if the product doesn't work, it's insurance. If it does work, it doesn't. It's not insurance?
No, if it is a sham product, if it is one that has no utility at all. And in the context of consumers on Oahu, where the police department makes no use of this and finds them useless, it is simply a sham product, because then all is left is the sale of the indemnity. To analyze this, I think you have to ask yourselves.
Can you prevail just a 480 unfair deceptive claim practice and not even allege insurance?
We could have, and we think we should have. We think for a couple of reasons that I'll address, the circuit court should have recognized that a simple garden variety plain vanilla 480-2 claim was before her, and judgment should have been denied on that basis alone. But I think in looking at this principal purpose and insurance question, you should ask yourselves, if Qatar had told consumers what was in Detective Nobrega's declaration, that it wasn't being used, it was useless, it wasn't a deterrent in the judgment of the police department car theft detail, how many people would have bought that product for the purpose of providing some protection against anything?
Well, you agree, though, it's undisputed, they weren't marketing it as insurance.
They weren't marketing it as insurance. But they were selling quite prominently the idea that if your car was stolen, you'd get a lot of money under certain circumstances.
Not that much, given the value of a car.
Well, this is some money. I mean, we think that from the standpoint of the insurance argument, if the purpose of if any purpose other than just indemnity disappears because the product is illusory, as the insurance commissioner said, or useless.
One thing that doesn't jump out at me as a former lawyer that represented plaintiffs on occasion, what's the value to the plaintiffs proceeding under 431 as opposed to 480?
The argument is that you can build a treble damage claim out of 431, and so you end up in much the same place. But it is just one hook in addition to the plain vanilla garden variety 480-2 claim. Okay. So with respect to this insurance issue, our argument is not that a product that simply fails is could be considered the insurance if it's accompanied by a warranty, but a product which is a sham and illusory constitutes insurance because all that's left then is the sale of the indemnity obligation.
Mr. Alston, under your theory, does the seller have to know that it's a sham?
I think the seller, that issue wasn't explored, obviously, below, but it would seem to me that the seller has to have some good faith belief that in the jurisdiction where the product is being offered, that it in fact has some utility at all. If there is no basis for believing that it has utility, if they haven't gone to the police department and said, by the way, we're offering this product, and we have this system so that if you find a stolen car, here's a way, and the VIN has been crossed, marked off or defaced or so forth, here's a way to find it. But what's significant here is that there was a twist to this case, because it wasn't that the Qatar defendants were selling the safeguard system, although they were using the safeguard etch, but they had misappropriated those etches and the numbers and the contact information provided on the etches. And so, you've got a situation where they're selling what appears to be a safeguard etch, but it's one that they've taken and misappropriated, as the record reflects, for their own purposes. So you've got two layers of deception. Even if the safeguard system works, does it work when the etches have been misappropriated as they were here?
Yes. Are these safeguard?
What's that?
Are these products from safeguard?
No. Well, the etch was, the record reflects, this is in volume 17. There are some declarations about this, that Qatar was using the safeguard etch, the little piece that goes on the window with the chemical. But that they had no authority from Safeguard to be using them, and that Red Swan and Qatar had set up their own independent operation using Safeguard's etch, but not registering and not paying Safeguard, which is why Safeguard eventually, as the record reflects, was settled out of the case, because they were not involved in the marketing or the deployment of this system at all.
Are these pre-market or post-market etchings?
Post-market. They don't come from the factory that way.
Qatar defendants actually brought the car that was purchased to Red Star, and they did the etching after?
Red Swan. I believe the etching, I don't think the record is clear on this point, or there's evidence in the record, but my understanding is that the etches were actually put on by Qatar personnel, and that Red Swan simply supplied the etches that they had taken improperly from Safeguard. So the second proposition is that in this context. The circuit court should have recognized that the claim for unfair trade practices was more than insurance related. There was, as we said, inter alia. That was one claim among a number of claims, or a number of theories, if you will, on which the 480-2 claim was based. And the Qatar defendants recognized that there was something more than just insurance involved here in their own pretrial statement in the Colizo case, where they said to the court that they were not selling insurance and that the product was not unfair and deceptive for other reasons as well. So they recognized that this wasn't just limited to insurance. But even if, and I admit the complaint was not a model of clarity on this point, and the use of inter alia in hindsight was probably not the best way to frame the issue, but it was enough to create notice that there was something more, and if the Qatar defendants had any doubt, they should have filed a motion for a more definite statement. They could have, they didn't. I submit that the record reflects, as I said in their pretrial statement, that they knew there was something more there.
Isn't there moving for summary judgment adequate? I mean, to basically raise the issue?
Well, I believe that the way that the summary judgment was in fact framed and argued by both parties, it reflected the understanding that there was more there. In our opposition brief, we expressly said that this was about more than whether it was just insurance. We pointed to Detective Nobrega's declaration and said this is about more than just...
How did you frame that?
More than just insurance. That there were other unfair and deceptive aspects to what the Qatar defendants were doing than just selling illegal insurance.
And you were specific in what those other unfair practices were?
I believe in the last section of our opposition memo, there is a discussion pointing specifically to Detective Nobrega's declaration that says, basically, this is a sham product. This is useless. It doesn't have the benefits that are ascribed to it.
Tying that to 480 and arguing even if it's not insurance, it's still a 480 claim?
Correct.
So it's not your position that just because they were selling unauthorized insurance,
right,
that it was that violation of the insurance laws is automatically a UDEP?
It can be. I suspect, without thinking about it too deeply, I think it's possible that there are some examples of selling illicit insurance that aren't a UDEP, perhaps. But it's our position that our claims, our 480-2 claim, is not confined to the sale of illegal insurance. It also included the unfair and deceptive marketing of this proprietary etch, which, on Oahu at least, was useless. Now, so whether the complaint was enough to bring this garden variety 480-2 issue into the case, or whether you have to look to what the parties actually briefed and argued, we believe the circuit court erred by ignoring the hotly disputed record and granting summary judgment on that issue. Now, in our opening brief, we cited a number of cases that said that where even if a complaint doesn't raise a particular claim, if the parties brief and argue it in summary judgment, then effectively the pleadings have been amended. In response, there was no counter from the Qatar defendants. They simply did not address that point at all and effectively conceded it. And as they must. I mean, the law is clear that if through their actions the parties have brought something into a case and they've framed it and argued it and briefed it, and then that issue was in the case, and we think it was there. We think the circuit judge should have recognized that the record was at worst for us, one on which there were genuine issues of material fact as to whether the marketing of this product was unfair and deceptive, and therefore the 480-2 claim should not have been dismissed on summary judgment.
Does it indicate in the record how many consumers actually purchase this?
There was a great deal of effort put into trying to find that out. And by the time summary judgment was granted, our discovery efforts on that score had been rebuffed again, and we never were able to determine how many. We understand, although it's not in the record, that it was a very large number of consumers, on the order of thousands.
And the stipulated judgment that was entered, which the original named plaintiffs are out of this case.
They are. They accepted a settlement.
Each?
What's that?
They got $2,500 each.
They got a stipend for their service, and in addition, every member of the class got some coupons. This, but that was unrelated to the VTR. That was on a different claim entirely, relating to the assessment of a document fee that we thought was.
So the stipulated judgment didn't refer to this vehicle protection plan. It's only the document fee.
The settlement was related to the document fee. What remained intact and was preserved for this appeal was all the issues related to the insurance claim, the insurance UDAP claim, that related to the marketing of the VTR claim, if you will. Okay. In any event, regardless of where the record stood at the time summary judgment was granted, the circuit court should have allowed the plaintiffs to amend their complaint to include more specifically the garden variety theory of 480-2. If you review the record, although the case began in 2002, they moved very, very slowly up to the point where summary judgment was granted. There had been very little discovery accomplished. There had been no depositions that I can recall. In any event, there certainly wasn't much in the way of deposition discovery. And if you compare the volume of the record that existed when the summary judgment was brought, and we were in volume 5, and when we finished and we're in volume, I believe, 23, it's apparent that the case was still in its infancy. There had been no trial date set. There was no reason not to allow the plaintiffs to present all the claims that, or all the theories that they had for relief under 480-2. And that's especially true in light of the timing of Detective Nobrega's declaration, which frames this issue very clearly and in a new way that doesn't appear in the record before that. And that comes just on the eve of summary judgment. And so when the court says, I'm not going to allow you to amend, you look at that declaration and say, wait a minute, it's a new ballgame in light of Detective Nobrega's statements about how this is a useless product. So in sum, I would ask that you reverse and remand, and allow us to have a trial on these 480-2 theories.
Mr. Olson, you're not saying we should decide at this level, at this time, whether or not this was insurance?
Absolutely not. All I want is a trial, and all I want is an opportunity to prove to a jury that this was a sham product, and that the only purpose of selling it then was the promise of indemnity, because there was, in fact, no bona fide promise of anything more than that. Lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the appellee's citation to the unpublished decision in the Merck case. It was clearly improper, and I expected better from my distinguished colleagues. I submit that if they had viable arguments, they would not have cited that unpublished opinion, which should never have been mentioned in its brief. And I hope you will view their tactic in doing so the same way. And I have nothing further unless you have questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Munger.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lisa Munger, appearing on behalf of the Cutter defendants, and with me is my counsel, Joachim Cox. First, let me start by taking the opportunity to appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument. I appreciate it's not a right, and I do appreciate the opportunity. I thought before talking about the VTR product and some of the arguments made in our brief that I might answer a few of the questions posed by the court and clarify a few of the items from the record that I think may have been inadvertently misstated. First, early on in the argument, Your Honor asked a question with respect to a complaint before the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. And counsel did not recall that particular complaint concerned the license fee which was one of the components of the original complaint. And particularly at issue there was the practice of charging a set fee for the license rather than one which was the exact amount of the license charged by the city and county of Honolulu. So that issue is not on our appeal today. That issue that was raised as a means of tolling the statute of limitations. The entirety of the license fee portion of the case, the document fee portion of the case, that was all settled. And that was the portion of the case that related to all purchasers of Cutter vehicles through the pertinent time period. Next, I wanted the record certainly to clarify something that came as a surprise to me, counsel's statement that somehow this etch was misappropriated and that was somehow an issue in this case. The record reflects that that Safeguard was paid $1 for on the sale of each of these etches, and the Red Swan was the vehicle administrator. But there was no claim in the complaint or in summary judgment or at any other time in this case that this alleged, for the first time today, as far as I know, misappropriation had anything to do with the consumer's purchase of the VTR product at the Cutter dealership. So that's not in the record. And then finally, I think counsel may have misrecalled the settlement as well. In the course of the settlement, the initial plaintiff class representatives, and my recollection is that there were 11 of them, did not receive any compensation from the Cutter defendants as part of the settlement. The only plaintiff who received a compensation for her role as class representative was Ms. Tokuhisa, now Ms. Swan. So if perhaps the council may have given them something, but our settlement does not call for them to have received anything because at the time of the settlement, they were not the class representatives. So they received a coupon like everyone else. With that, let me, if I can, address the issues with respect to the VTR product. And let me begin by emphasizing again, we're hearing arguments that were not put to the court below and were not even put, frankly, some of them in the appeal briefs that are before the court today. The product that's at issue in this appeal is that when the plaintiff purchased her car from Cutter, she also purchased this vehicle theft registration or VTR product. I would stress that this is her choice. It was completely optional. This was not pre-installed. It was not a fee being charged. This is an optional purchase. And the record reflects that for that reason, the VTR class is a subclass or a subset of all of the consumers who purchased from the Cutter defendants over the period at issue here. So what was it that she elected to purchase? The product consisted of three things. First is the window etch itself. The second is the registration of that identification number with an administrator. And the third component is a written warranty. Now, there is absolutely no dispute that a visible identification code was chemically etched into the windows of plaintiff's vehicle. There's no question of that. And what we heard today was an interesting concession, I thought, that if the VIN number had been etched, then there wouldn't be a problem at all. And the problem was that a number other than the VIN was what was etched in the window. Well, that, of course, is a theory that is nowhere in the complaint. That's a theory that wasn't briefed and argued to the court. And Your Honors, I would suggest that it's a theory that doesn't make a great deal of sense because the concept of, as set forth in the briefing before the court, the concept of the etch is to deter the initial theft because the criminal or person looking for a joyride, whatever, looks at the etching on the window and that is the etch itself that deters the person from stealing a vehicle. It doesn't matter whether the etch is the VIN, some other number, or a little sign that says, this car belongs to Lisa Munger. The what was etched was never at issue in the complaint in this case. The second thing that's...
Didn't the officer testify that the problem with these numbers was that when you called Safeguard or whoever it was that was supposed to be the registrar of these numbers, that they had no record that of these numbers? So no. It was illusory in the sense that they didn't work.
Well, what the product warrants is that the... And this is specifically in the warranty that's attached that the plaintiff signed, is that the when it is properly equipped with the VTR window etch, the etching system will be an effective deterrent against vehicle theft. Officer Nobriga testified is the police department did not have those numbers in its system. Nobriga did not testify that the etch would not deter theft. Similarly, there is no doubt, and it is not claimed in this case, that any one of these plaintiffs had an etch, had the vehicle stolen, and didn't get paid. There is no claim in this complaint about the efficacy of the etch. We were presented with absolutely no evidence that this system did not work to deter theft, or even that if theft had not been deterred and the vehicle had not been recovered because of the claim we're hearing today that the wrong number was etched, that the $2,500 was not paid.
Did the plaintiffs get their cars stolen?
No, none of them. There is no claim in the complaint that the plaintiff's car was stolen. And none of the other class representatives had their class stolen.
Isn't the Nobriga declaration some evidence that it didn't deter?
That what?
That this etching did not deter thefts?
No, to the contrary. The Nobriga declaration does not say that the product does not deter theft. All the Nobriga declaration said is that the police department has VIN numbers rather than this identification code. And the declaration of Herman Jones, which was not disputed, was that it is the etching of the glass that is the deterrent to the theft because chop shops and others know that replacing window glass is expensive. Again, it does not matter what is etched.
So it's your position, it's undisputed material fact that the record shows that there is no evidence that this etching doesn't work.
Correct. There was no evidence that the etching doesn't work. But more importantly, Your Honor,
that's not in dispute.
That is not in dispute. And more importantly, we were not warranting that your car would never be stolen. We were not warranting 100% efficacy. We were warranting that it was a deterrent.
Some effective.
That had some effective deterrent. That's all we warranted.
Now, let's, just for purposes of argument, if it didn't deter, would that have any impact on their 482, 431 claim that because it didn't deter, it must have been insurance?
No, exactly. I mean, the product was not insurance because simply it was a warranty. All it was we will... If we are not an effective deterrent and your car is stolen and not recovered, we will pay you $2,500.
That certainly sounds like insurance to me. I mean, the definition of insurance under our insurance code is one undertakes to indemnify another or pay a specified amount upon determinable contingencies. So you're saying, okay, we believe in our product so much that if it is actually stolen, we're going to pay you this. So there is a contingency here, and you're promising to pay a certain amount. So that certainly sounds like insurance. And if the whole purpose of the insurance code is to make sure that people that are promising to pay these amounts, you know, deposit money with the insurance commissioner so that they can back up their claims, then why would this not constitute insurance?
Well, there's no question, Your Honor, that there is an element of indemnity. But, of course, there's an element of indemnity in every single warranty. We warrant if our product doesn't work, we will replace it. We will take care of the damage. We will do many, many warranties. If you have the club, if it doesn't work, we'll pay you this. All of those things are warranties. And that's why we directed the court's attention below and as well as on appeal to a series of California cases that set forth the primary objective and purpose and distinctive characteristic test. And frankly, in reviewing those cases for those four cases for argument today, the two that really resonated with me were the ones that dealt with cars and trucks, and that would be first the 1946 case of Jellins, Transportation Guarantee Company versus Jellins, which was the one in which there was a truck maintenance contract, which provided that the contractor would maintain the trucks, garage the trucks, fuel the trucks, as well as insure them. I mean, it specifically said that he would insure those trucks. And the California Supreme Court had no problem finding that the reading the contract, reading what the parties themselves had agreed to make the determination that the first, that the contract should be judged by its own terms as written, but second, that the controlling object of the contract was service. It was the labor. It was all of the, it was the things that were provided to the, in connection with the truck. So even being insured, having actual insurance as an element of the contract did not make the whole contract a contract of insurance. And then that 1946 case, of course, was one of the basis for the later cases, the Avis Rent-A-Car case, Truta, which was in 1987, in which plaintiffs sued Avis, Hertz, and the other major car rental companies for having a collision damage waiver, which, of course, also sounds a great deal like insurance. For $6 a day, if your car is, if you're in a collision, we will cover it. And that court, again, did something very important, and that was look to the language of the contract itself. Look at the contract as a whole to make the determination of whether that insurance, that collision damage waiver, made the contract one of insurance, and concluded that it did not, that what it was a contract for was the rental of a car, and the primary purpose was the rental of the car.
In those cases, was there an insurance code similar to Hawaii's?
Yes, the California insurance code is similar to Hawaii's, and in one of the footnotes of our brief, we have the California insurance code language, which I think the court will find is very similar to the Hawaii insurance code in connection with describing the element of frankly, the language that Your Honor had previously mentioned.
Well, you know, when you look at Webster's, it talks about what a warranty is. It's a written guarantee of integrity of a product and the maker's responsibility and repair of defective parts. So when you talk about those warranties for repair of your cars, they sound like warranties to me. But when you inject that additional, we're going to pay if, It seems to make it more like insurance.
I think it makes it, perhaps, Your Honor, it makes it more like the Avis case where the court said that obviously they're sharing risk in connection with the collision waiver, which is certainly something that most people would consider insurance. And in our case, what we warranted was that we would, that it would be an effective deterrent against theft. And so, since what we're warranting is the deterrent against theft, it really wouldn't make a great deal of sense to warrant simply the decal to say, well, if your car is stolen, we'll give you a free decal for your next car. That really isn't an effective warranty against theft. All ours says is that we will pay the registered, we will pay you $2,500 if your car is stolen and not recovered. That's what we believe. Because we believe our product is of value. And it's certainly in that connection. If this product were, the issue in the complaint, which is what the court dealt with, was whether this was insurance. That was the issue. The inter alia is not some magic wand from which I, as counsel for the other side, should have known. If this theory fails, another one is coming, So you'd better ask me what inter alia means. I don't quite know that I've ever seen anyone phrase an interrogatory or a document request or a request for admissions, tell me what inter alia means. What are your other theories other than those in the complaint? That's an unreasonable burden. As counsel for Qatar, what I did was a reasonable thing. I understood this to be a case about insurance, and then I brought a motion for summary judgment setting forth that this was a product with a warranty, this was not insurance. Now, counsel makes much of the fact that, well, it was only then, only at the motions for summary judgment, that this allegedly new information came up about Mr. Nobrega indicating that the Honolulu Police Department prefers VIN etches to other number etches. But, Your Honor, I would point out that at that time, plaintiffs made absolutely no effort to amend the complaint. The motion to amend the complaint to state this new sham theory was not made until a year after our motion for summary judgment. And surely Judge McKenna is the person who is in the best position to know the procedural posture of her case, the substantive posture of her case, and to know when a great deal of water has gone under the bridge, where she has made her determination on summary judgment that VTR is no longer part of the case and that is in the should be given the deference to determine that 3 years after the complaint, 1 year after summary judgment is simply too late.
Judge McKenna seemed to have also looked at the legislative history of Act 237, but when you look at Act 237, it seems to carve out your company's products. Is that correct? Or why is that? Why did the legislature say it didn't apply to VTR systems that didn't rely on a VIN number?
In connection with Act 237, which became Chapter 481R, the legislature reviewed the various vehicle protection products that were available. You know, and actually, Your Honor, it was including but not limited to the window etch product. It included the club. It included any starter interrupt, any other products. The legislative history does not indicate why that definition was provided, but I think, Your Honor, it was for the purpose of uniformity, that in order to describe the product, that was how the legislature described it. But it was plain that the concern of the legislature in 2002 was not that consumers had any difficulty with the products that were being sold. Indeed, the legislative history reflects that the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs reported that there had been no consumer complaints. And I do want to emphasize that the other matter in the complaint did not in any way deal with VTR. So there was no consumer complaints or DCCA complaints with respect to VTR. What the legislature was trying to do was protect the automobile companies and others from a series of lawsuits that were marching across the country and popping up here in Hawaii, claiming that the sale of these products with the warranty was insurance. That was the purpose of these provisions, and to make it clear that they were warranties, that they were not, and to provide a safe harbor to make it absolutely clear that one could not be sued for them. And I think that the description in the legislative history is simply that. It's simply by way of indicating the safe harbor and indicating the product. I think another, to sort of go back to the issue of something being a sham product, Your Honor, I would be very concerned if what counsel is arguing is that 480 was a vehicle for the legislature to impose on the consumers of our state to take away their opportunity to buy those products that they want to buy. And to pay what they feel they want to pay for certain products. We could have many arguments as to whether some products are good, some products are valuable, or
a
sham. Isn't
the plaintiff's position, whether or not the record supports their position, is another matter, clearly, but isn't it their position the consumer was not getting what they thought they were paying for? I mean, at least today.
That may have been the theory that was articulated today, but there is nothing in the record to reflect that the consumer was getting something other than exactly what they were buying for. The contract says that we will etch a unique identification code on your car. That was etched. It's quite visible. That's the whole point of it. It's visible. The consumer would know when you look at that number, it's not the VIN number. The VIN number is not only elsewhere on the car, it's also on your contract, it's on your drive, on your vehicle registration. So,
but there's no question, there's no problem for the consumer that buys the Edge, has their car stolen, gets their $2,500.
Right.
Other than the disparity, possibly, between the $2,500 and the real value of the car, if they thought the Edge had some utility, if it turned out, it's your position, there's no facts to support this, if the Edge had no utility and no deterrent value, then clearly that consumer may have a claim for the difference between the warranty and the value of the car, but it's the real claim would be for the, assuming that the Edge was not a deterrent, would be the consumers who are paying for this who don't have their car stolen.
Correct, Your Honor. There really is no, and that is another element of this claim, is that there is no injury to the consumer. Again, this is not a case about whether the VIN
or... Wouldn't there be if they're paying for something that's not what they think it is?
Well, if they were paying for something that's not what they think it is, yes, but that's not what's alleged in this complaint or supported in this record. What's alleged in this complaint is that the problem was that Qatar should have had an insurance license in order to sell the product.
It's your position that whether or not it's insurance is purely a question of law?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that the purpose of this product is a question of law?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason, and I would note that in the California cases, in fact, all of the cases here, that are in our appeal brief and were argued to Judge McKenna below, are ones in which the court made that determination as a matter of law based on the record before them. Particularly those cases, and I would cite to the four California cases particularly, where there was a written agreement. Now, perhaps there's a case out there where there wasn't a written agreement, so there was some issue of fact. But the cases we've decided, we have cited to you said, is here's the written contract, and here's what it said, and as a matter of law, we're going to interpret this contract. That's what courts do. So I think it was wholly appropriate for the trial court and for this court to determine that this contract, which is really what's at issue here, this contract is not a contract of insurance. Again, there is no claim in the complaint, nor was there made a claim on summary judgment, that the consumer was somehow misled at the dealership. This doesn't have anything to do with, oh, the service manager told me this or that. That's not a part of this case. That, of course, wouldn't even be appropriate for a class action. The only thing at issue here is this contract. And plaintiffs kept it that narrow, of course, so that they could have a class action. And say that all of these purchasers of this product purchased this contract.
The complaint says that the policy was deceptive, that's how I read it, because it didn't explain that cutters would not pay unless there was comprehensive insurance in force. The theft resulted in total loss. The comprehensive insurer paid at least $2,500, and the insured purchased a comparable vehicle within 120 days. Where does that come from? Is that in the policy?
I have no... first place, of course, that argument was not an argument posed in the complaint or on summary judgment that there was some unfair thing.
This is in the complaint.
This is the... What's in the complaint is that the provisions in the contract are what they are, and if that provision was in the contract, that is what the plaintiff signed. I do not recall there being a complaint that it was an unfair and deceptive trade practice to have those terms, or that those terms precluded anyone, any plaintiff, any member of the class from being paid.
So it's your position that as long as somebody purchased this system and their car was stolen, and they didn't get it back in 30 days, you, no questions, just pay the $2,500?
Well, Your Honor, I don't, my understanding is that there is, I'm unaware of any claim of anyone who did not get paid their $2,500 for whatever reason. And I am not familiar with the claims processing. That wasn't in the record. But there's nothing in the record about claims. There were no complaints about claims processing. None.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate where the $2,500 figure comes from?
No. No. And I think it was, an, you know, I think that it, it no. I surely appreciate that a car may have, it certainly would have greater value than $2,500. On the other hand, cars also have other insurance. You know, it's a supplement. I don't know how that number was taken. I wanted, again, Your Honors, to, in closing, just to indicate that this is a case that should be ruled upon, as Judge McKenna saw it, on the motions that were before her. And these later attempts to recharacterize it, to make it something different, to a year after summary judgment, to bring in new theories, new claims, gee, I wish I had done something else, I'm very hopeful will fall on deaf ears. I'd like at this moment to use the few remaining moments my defense counsel, Lane Hornbeck, wanted to clarify a matter for the court. She is the counsel also in this matter.
Good morning, Honors. Lane Hornbeck on behalf of Safeguard Products International, Inc. To the extent that Ms. Munger may have inadvertently implied this, Safeguard disagrees with representation of Ms. Munger that Safeguard was paid any money in connection with the sale of the vehicle theft registration product marketed by Cutter. Furthermore, to the extent that there is any implication that Safeguard had knowledge of, participated in, or authorized the VTR program, Safeguard simply rejects that position. Lastly, Safeguard wants to state for the record that Safeguard had settled and has settled with all parties in this action and is no longer an active participant in this case.
Thank you.
Mr. Alston, before you begin, could you respond to counsel's comment of a delay of 1 year to file the amended complaint after?
The declaration of Detective Nobrega was dated September 3, 03. The summary judgment motion was filed September 12, 03. Summary judgment was granted on December 1, 03. The motion to file the amended complaint was filed on January 6, 2004. That is a period of three or 4 months, not a year. It is simply wrong that there was that kind of delay. It is also wrong, and this is a crucial point, that there was no evidence in the record that the etch does not deter or serves any deterrent purpose. Detective Nobrega's declaration says, paragraph 7, that he does not believe that they have any value in deterring auto theft in Honolulu. Since Ms. Munger has agreed that that was a genuine issue and a material issue, it is no doubt clear from that statement in Detective Nobrega's declaration that was a disputed issue of fact that had to be put to the jury. The fact that there was no deterrent purpose is shown by the record. Now, Ms. Munger cites the declaration of a Mr. Jones who was affiliated with Cutter and says that there was no objection to Mr. Jones' declaration about his views on this issue. In fact, there was an opposition to all of that. If you read our opposition to their summary judgment motion, we expressly said that there were problems with much of the evidence that they offered insofar as it was hearsay and otherwise inadmissible on a motion for summary judgment, so that in that respect, Ms. Munger was unfortunately wrong. She is correct that the Office of Consumer Protection complaint, which I did not remember, but which my co-counsel did, related only to the document fee and not related to the VTR. She is correct, unfortunately I misremembered, that the class representatives, the original class representatives, didn't get any money. What happened is there was an offer of judgment that they accepted, and that they were later, the Qatar defendants were later allowed to withdraw, leaving the original class representatives with nothing more than a coupon. Ms. Tokuhisa did, with court approval, get some stipend for her service with respect to the VTR, excuse me, with respect to the document fee claims. She's also wrong about whether the record reflects the misappropriation of the safeguard stickers, as implied in Ms. Hornfeck's statement. That is reflected in the record. There are, in volume 17, there are declarations from Mr. Swanee, who is the source of the name Red Swan, and Mr. Duncan, an employee of Safeguard, reflecting the fact that the Safeguard stickers were used without authorization, without either the knowledge or support of Safeguard. Ms. Munger also commented on her views about whether these etches serve a deterrent purpose. I mean, that's an interesting jury argument, and something that an expert or a lay witness might offer some testimony to a trial court about and to a jury about, but it's not something on which either the circuit court could grant summary judgment or on which you can or should rely in upholding the grant of summary judgment. There is, in fact, a very clear dispute about whether this product was simply a sham or illusory, as the insurance commissioner indicated in his testimony to the legislature.
And it pretty much goes, according to your position, to the Nobrega Declaration.
It does.
That's what gets it to the jury.
Well, that and the testimony of the insurance commissioner, which was also in the record. Under Rule of Evidence 803A sub 5, a statement by a public body or a public agency on matters within the scope of its jurisdiction is evidence. It's not hearsay. And where the insurance commissioner has told the legislature that it's investigated, found that these private, found that etches aren't used, that also gets us to the jury.
Assuming we agree with you that this is insurance.
Yes.
What kind of damages did your plaintiff suffer?
Basically, well, it comes not just from the fact that they bought illegal insurance, but also the intertwined argument that they bought something that was a sham and useless. The etch cost 38 cents. They paid hundreds of dollars for it. They could have obtained, at some point, a free VIN etch from the police department. I submit that our damages consisted of paying a huge amount of money for something that had no value. If it was illegal, and if it was insurance and had been treated as such, then the insurance commissioner would have had some influence, if not outright control, over rates. If, for example, the record showed that they sold 20,000 of these at $300 a piece, and they paid 5 or 6 or 10 claims at $2,500 a piece, the insurance commissioner would certainly come in and look at that disparity and say, wait a minute, this is insurance. You're charging far, far too much for the cost of the actual benefit delivered. That's the kind of rate regulation that the insurance commissioner routinely exercises over.
But the insurance commissioner never did that.
No, because it was not recognized as insurance.
The insurance commissioner didn't recognize it as insurance?
Well, at first it was off the insurance commissioner's radar for a long time, obviously. Second, when it came onto his radar and he then begins to testify to the legislature about his views of this product, it is clearly something that, you know, raises these issues. But we say that our position is that if this had been recognized and regulated as insurance, then the consumers would have had the benefit of rate regulation and supervision, and we submit would not have paid for this kind of product. Certainly anything approaching $300 or thereabouts, which they paid.
I mean, everybody in this room probably has gotten a letter from a company saying your warranty on your refrigerator is expiring,
right.
Extend it. Do you consider that to be insurance as well?
No. If people are offering to sell legitimate protection against the failure of a product that has some undeniable utility, or if they are allocating risk in a contractual arrangement, then it's not insurance. And that's why the defendant's reliance on the auto rental cases fails. I mean, if Hertz rents a car and it gets damaged, somebody's going to have to pay. It's either the guy who rented the car or the company that owns the car. And if all they're doing is allocating risk as a matter of contract between them, that's acceptable, and it's not insurance. But where it's a sham product, if they're offering to sell, you know, refrigerator magnets to stick on the door to make the refrigerator work better, that's not. Then what they're really selling is the indemnity contract. They're not selling a product. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement.